urgently needed to control. I was too belligerent. The minute someone made a statement, I looked for ways to contradict it. When someone happened to say to me, "Over the next 50 years, it's the relationship with China that will be the most important to the United States," I started searching my mind to think of counterexamples. Why? Why argue just for the sake of disagreeing? I know very little about the subject. Going to law school had intensified this inclination. I was trained to argue, and I prided myself at being good at it. But most people don't enjoy arguing as much as law students do. In daily life, my argumentativeness wasn't much of a problem, but I'd noticed that drinking alcohol made me far more combative than I usually was. Plus, it weakened my not very strong instinct for good manners. Because I never did drink much, and had given up drinking twice while pregnant, and because of my metabolism, I'd developed a very low tolerance for alcohol. Again and again, I lay in my bed after some social event, thinking, "Was I as obnoxious as I think? Why did I make my point in such a negative way?" And Jamie usually wasn't very reassuring about how I'd behaved. I was determined to get control of my combativeness. I might not have thought to accomplish this by quitting drinking, except that when Jamie stopped drinking because of his hepatitis C, I'd cut back even further on my drinking to keep him company in abstinence. I found it such a relief to be drinking less that I decided to give up drinking practically altogether, a decision that was actually somewhat predictable because, as I knew from my February research, the fact that Jamie gave up alcohol meant that I was 5 times as likely to quit drinking. Not drinking made me much happier. I'd never particularly enjoyed the taste of beer or wine. I can't stand real liquor. I'd never enjoyed the buzz of alcohol, and I'd much rather spend the calories on eating rather than drinking. I did miss the idea of drinking. That's one thing I love about Winston Churchill. I love his zest for champagne and cigars. But as one of my secrets of adulthood says, what's fun for other people may not be fun for you. I had to accept the fact that no matter how much other people enjoyed alcohol, and despite the fact that I wished I enjoyed it, drinking wasn't fun for me. To the contrary, it was a source of bad feeling. Once I gave it up, mostly, I discovered another reason that drinking had made me rude. It made me sleepy. It was much easier to be polite and agreeable when I wasn't in an agony of exhaustion. As I'd noticed in earlier months, it's easier to feel happier and use good manners when I make the effort to stay physically comfortable, to dress warmly, even when people make fun of my long underwear, double sweaters, or mugs of hot water, to snack more often. I seem to need to eat far more frequently than most adults do, to turn off the lights as soon as I feel sleepy, and to take pain medication as soon as I have a headache. The Duke of Wellington advised, "Always make water when you can," and I followed that precept, too. It was much easier to behave pleasantly when I wasn't shivering, scouting for a bathroom, or on my second glass of wine. Give positive reviews. I wanted to laugh more, I wanted to show more loving kindness, and I also wanted to be more enthusiastic. I knew that it wasn't nice to criticize, but it was fun. Why was it so deliciously satisfying to criticize? Being critical made me feel more sophisticated and intelligent. And in fact, studies show that people who are critical are often perceived to be more discerning. In one study, for example, people judged the writers of negative book reviews as more expert and competent than the writers of positive reviews, even when the content of both reviews was deemed to be of high quality. Another study showed that people tend to think that someone who criticizes them is smarter than they are. Also, when a person disrupts a group's unanimity, he or she lessens its social power. I've seen people exploit this phenomenon. When a group is cheerfully unanimous on a topic like, "The teacher is doing a great job," or "This restaurant is terrific," such a person takes the opposite position to deflate the group's mood. Being critical has its advantages, and what's more, it's much easier to be hard to please. Although enthusiasm seems easy and undiscriminating, in fact, it's much harder to embrace something than to disdain it. It's riskier. When I examined my reactions to other people, I realized that I do often view people who make critical remarks as more perceptive and more discriminating. At the same time, though, it's hard to find pleasure in the company of someone who finds nothing pleasing. I prefer the company of the more enthusiastic types, who seem less judgmental, more vital, more fun. For example, one evening, as part of a surprise birthday party for a close friend, we went to a Barry Manilow concert, because my friend loves Barry Manilow. Afterward, I reflected that it showed considerable strength of character to be such an avowed Barry Manilow fan. After all, Barry Manilow is, well, Barry Manilow. It would be so much safer to mock his music, or to enjoy it in an ironic, campy way, than to admire it wholeheartedly as she did. Enthusiasm is a form of social courage. What's more, people's assessments are very influenced by other people's assessments. So when my friend said, "This is terrific music, this is a great concert," her enthusiasm lifted me up. I wanted to embrace this kind of zest. I steeled myself to stop making certain kinds of unnecessarily negative statements. "I really don't feel like going. The food was too rich. There's nothing worth reading in the paper." Instead, I tried to look for ways to be sincerely enthusiastic. For example, one afternoon, at Jamie's suggestion, we left the girls with his parents while we went to a movie. When we came back to pick them up, my mother-in-law asked, "How was the movie?" Instead of following my inclination to say, "Well, not bad," I answered, "It was such a treat to go see a movie in the afternoon." That's a response that's much more likely to boost happiness, not only in her, but also in me. Giving positive reviews requires humility. I have to admit, I missed the feelings of superiority that I got from using puncturing humor, sarcasm, ironic asides, cynical comments, and cutting remarks. A willingness to be pleased requires modesty and even innocence, easy to deride as mawkish and sentimental. For the first time, I appreciated the people I knew who were unfailingly ready to be pleased. A prayer attributed to St. Augustine of Hippo includes the line, "Shield your joyous ones. Tend your sick ones, O Lord Jesus Christ. Rest your weary ones. Bless your dying ones. Soothe your suffering ones. Pity your afflicted ones. Shield your joyous ones, and all for your love's sake." At first, it struck me as odd that among prayers for the dying and suffering is a prayer for the joyous. Why worry about the joyous ones? Once I started trying to give positive reviews, though, I began to understand how much happiness I took from the joyous ones in my life, and how much effort it must take for them to be consistently good-tempered and positive. It is easy to be heavy, hard to be light. We non-joyous types suck energy and cheer from the joyous ones. We rely on them to buoy us with their good spirit and to cushion our agitation and anxiety. At the same time, because of a dark element in human nature, we're sometimes provoked to try to shake the enthusiastic, cheery folk out of their fog of illusion, to make them see that the play was stupid, the money was wasted, the meeting was pointless. Instead of shielding their joy, we blast it. Why is this? I have no idea, but that impulse is there. I wrote about this prayer on my blog, and several readers who identified themselves as joyous ones responded. For example, "This entry almost made me cry. As one of the joyful ones, I agree wholeheartedly that it can be draining, too, and it takes so little to show your appreciation. I'm one of those people who wakes up happy every day, not because nothing ever goes wrong in my life, because I choose to be happy, literally. For reasons I don't fully understand, people seem ticked off that I'm in a good mood. But they want to draw on that energy, too. It is exhausting sometimes. Gretchen, I am also a joyous one. I choose to be. I choose it every day. I have recently gone through a traumatic breakup because my boyfriend so couldn't stop blasting my joy, and yet also unrelentingly drawing upon it like a drowning person in a sea. I felt as if I was being pulled under more every day. I had to go or I wouldn't be able to breathe anymore. I didn't know anyone understood. These comments reminded me that the joy of the joyous ones wasn't inexhaustible or unconquerable. I started to make a real effort to use my good cheer to support the joyous ones I knew. To keep my resolution to give positive reviews, I resolved to employ the intensive approach I'd used during the week of extreme nice and the month of novel writing. Maybe a week of playing Pollyanna would help accelerate my move toward the positive. In Eleanor Porter's enormously successful 1913 novel, Pollyanna, Pollyanna plays the glad game. Whatever happens to her, she finds a reason to be glad about it. My own game, Pollyanna Week, would be a solid week of no negative comments. I knew I should act the way I want to feel, and if I wanted to feel enthusiastic, warm, and accepting, I wasn't going to get there by constantly making sniping comments. I woke up the first morning, deep in thought about Pollyanna Week, and by 7 a.m., I'd already broken it. Practically the first thing I said to Jamie was to chide him. You never answer my emails, and you didn't answer my email yesterday, so I couldn't get any of the scheduling issues settled. Do we need a babysitter for Thursday night or not? The next day, I did the same thing. We were all sitting around before school when Eleanor started pointing to her mouth, in what we thought was a cute way, until she started making gagging noises. Quick, get a towel, she's going to throw up, I yelled. Eliza darted into the kitchen, but she still hadn't emerged when Eleanor began heaving half-digested milk all over herself, me, and the furniture. Jamie, go get a towel! He'd been sitting, mesmerized by the sight. By the time they both rushed back from the kitchen with dish towels, Eleanor had finished throwing up, and she and I were wallowing in a big, yucky mess. Folks, that was not the fastest action we could have had, I scolded. We could have saved a lot of trouble if you'd been faster with those towels. Why did I throw out a negative comment? It added to the general loss of morale without making any useful point. One lesson that Pollyanna Week taught me was that I could usually make my point, even if it was critical, in a positive way. For example, I broke Pollyanna Week during a game of Finders Keepers with Eliza. The point of Finders Keepers is to accumulate the most tiles. Can I trade my baseball cap tile for your butterfly tile? Eliza asked after one round. Okay. We played another round. Can I trade my globe for your flower? Okay. We played another round. Can I trade my football for your ice cream sundae? I'd been getting increasingly annoyed. Eliza, it's tiresome when you keep trading tiles, I told her. Just keep what you get and you can trade them at the end. You get what you get, and you don't get upset. All right, she said cheerfully. Only later did I realize that I could have phrased my request without criticism. The game is more fun when we keep it moving fast. Can we trade at the end? That night I did a better job, largely because I was so tired that I went to sleep at 9. Being asleep is a great way to avoid being critical. But when I said to Jamie, I'm so exhausted that I'm going to bed now. Was that a complaint or a statement of fact? It counted as a complaint. I should have found a positive way to phrase it. Going to bed sounds so great to me that I think I'm going to turn out the light early. One big challenge of Pollyanna Week was remembering to keep my goal uppermost in my mind. During the activities of the day, I forgot my resolution. So, borrowing from some of the mindfulness strategies I had tried in October, on the third morning, I started wearing a wide orange bracelet for the rest of Pollyanna Week as a constant reminder of my goal to make only positive comments. The bracelet worked fairly well, except that once I caught myself complaining to a friend that the bracelet was too heavy and clunky. So much for reminding me to make only positive comments. But I did have moments of triumph. I didn't complain about our loss of internet service. I didn't grouse when Jamie baked 3 rich desserts in 3 nights. When Eliza accidentally ran Eleanor's stroller into the kitchen wall, where it made a dark mark, I let it go without making a fuss. And when Eleanor grabbed my lipstick off the counter, then dropped it into the toilet, I said, well, it was an accident. During Pollyanna Week, I never did manage to go an entire day without a negative comment, but I nevertheless declared it a successful exercise. The 100% compliance was an impossible ambition. Making the effort jolted me into an awareness of my usual attitude. The effect of Pollyanna Week lingered long after the week was up. Find an area of refuge. One fact of human nature is that people have a negativity bias. We react to the bad more strongly and persistently than to the comparable good. As I learned in February, within marriage, it takes at least 5 good acts to repair the damage of 1 critical or destructive act. With money, the pain of losing a certain sum is greater than the pleasure of gaining that sum. Hitting the bestseller list with 40 ways to look at Winston Churchill thrilled me less than a bad review upset me. One consequence of the negativity bias is that when people's minds are unoccupied, they tend to drift to anxious or angry thoughts. And rumination, dwelling on slights, unpleasant encounters, and sad events, leads to bad feelings. In fact, one reason that women are more susceptible to depression than men may be their greater tendency to ruminate. Men are more likely to distract themselves with an activity. Studies show that distraction is a powerful mood-altering device, and contrary to what a lot of people believe, persistently focusing on a bad mood aggravates rather than palliates it. I'd often noticed my own tendency to brood, and to counter this effect, I invented the idea of the area of refuge. Once, when I was back visiting my former law school, I noticed a sign by an elevator that declared that area an area of refuge. I guess it's where a person in a wheelchair or with some other difficulty should go in case of fire. The phrase stuck in my mind, and I decided that if I found myself dwelling on bad feelings, I'd seek a mental area of refuge. As an area of refuge, I often think about Churchill's speeches, in particular, his eulogy for Neville Chamberlain. Or I think about some of the funny things Jamie has done. Years ago, when we were first married, Jamie came into our bedroom in his boxers and announced, "I am Lord of the Dance," and hopped around with his arms straight at his sides. I still laugh every time I think about it. A friend told me that she thinks about her children. Another friend, not a writer, makes up short stories in her head. When Arthur Llewellyn Davies, the father of the boys who inspired Peter Pan, was recovering from an operation that removed his cheekbone and part of the roof of his mouth, he wrote a note to J.M. Barrie. "Among the things I think about, Michael going to school, S's blue dress, Burpham Garden, Kirby View across valley, Jack bathing, Peter answering chaff, Nicholas in the garden, George always." These phrases mean nothing to an outsider, but for him, they were areas of refuge. By the end of November, I'd realized that one of the most important lessons of the Happiness Project is that if I keep my resolutions and do the things that make me happier, I end up feeling happier and acting more virtuously. Do good, feel good. Feel good, do good. Over the course of the month, I noticed that a frequent subject of my negative comments was Eliza's hair. Jamie and I thought it looked cutest when it hung right above her shoulders, but she begged us to grow it long. "You can grow it long only if you promise to keep it brushed nicely and out of your face," I threatened, repeating the words that untold millions of parents have uttered, to no avail. She promised, but of course, her hair constantly hung in her face. "Eliza, brush your hair. It's all messy." "Eliza, you've got the dreaded middle part. Go part your hair on the side." "Eliza, get a ponytail holder or a barrette. You need to pull your hair back." "Eliza, you can't possibly tell me you've already brushed your hair." This criticism was no fun for her and no fun for me. I wanted to change this pattern. So the next time I wanted to fret about her hair, I said, "Bring me a brush," and I started to brush her hair. Not fast and rough, as I sometimes did when I was impatient in the morning, but gently. "I love seeing your hair smooth and shiny," I said. "Your hair looks beautiful." Eliza looked a little surprised. The next time I tried the same thing. "Let me brush your hair," I told her. "I love brushing your hair." She didn't get any better about keeping her hair tidy, but it didn't bother me as much. Chapter 12, December. Boot Camp Perfect. Happiness. Boot Camp Perfect. For 11 months, I'd been piling on the resolutions, and for this last month of December, I wanted to try Boot Camp Perfect. I would follow all of my resolutions all the time. I would aim to see nothing but gold stars glittering on my resolutions chart. This goal of perfection was daunting because following my resolutions took a huge amount of mental discipline and self-control. Not to mention, it took a lot of time. So for the month, I tidied, I cleared, I organized, I turned off the light. I sang in the morning, I laughed out loud, I acknowledged people's feelings, I left things unsaid. I blogged, I asked for help, I pushed myself, I showed up, I went off the path. I wrote in my one-sentence journal. I met with my writer's strategy group and my children's literature reading group. I listened to my hypnosis tape. I didn't eat any fake food. I bought needful things. Of course, I also failed to do these things. As hard as I tried during Boot Camp Perfect, I still didn't manage to keep all my resolutions. Resolutions. After all these months, I was still astonished at how effectively they worked to make me happy whenever I did faithfully keep them. I thought often of the 1764 journal entry of Samuel Johnson, who, as an inveterate resolution maker and resolution breaker, is one of the patron saints of the process. I have now spent 55 years in resolving, having, from the earliest time, almost that I can remember, been forming schemes of a better life. I have done nothing. The need of doing, therefore, is pressing, since the time of doing is short. O God, grant me to resolve aright and to keep my resolutions. Did I have even one single perfect day during December? Nope. But I kept trying. One helpful consequence of my happiness project was that even when I had a bad day, it was a good bad day. If I was feeling blue, I'd run through my mood-boosting strategies. Go to the gym, get some work done, keep myself from getting too hungry, cross a nagging task off my to-do list, connect with other people, spend some time having fun with my family. Sometimes, nothing really worked, but the nice thing about trying to ameliorate a bad mood by taking those kinds of constructive steps was that even when a day was bad, it had bright spots, and I could look back on a good bad day with satisfaction. One development had given me a huge shot of encouragement. After I'd posted an offer to send people my resolutions chart in case they wanted to see a model as they formulated their own resolutions, I'd started to get emails from people describing their happiness projects. Several people had even started their own blogs to track them. I was gratified to think that I'd convinced some readers to try the method and resolutions that had worked for me. For example, thank you very much for sharing your resolutions chart. My husband and I are going to create a month of resolutions. I think the exercise will be both fun and a good bonding experience for us after an emotionally rocky few months. We haven't sat down to do it yet, which is yet another symptom of how work keeps us from spending quality time together. Just talked about doing it soon, but I've been thinking about simple resolutions, like date night, express physical affection, do something new together, listen to her/him, play hooky from work for an afternoon, go for a drive. We always talk better stuck in a car together. We just realized there are a lot of things we take for granted, having been together for so long, and there are so many little things that we're realizing we have neglected over time that would probably make us happier if we paid attention to them now. I have been inspired recently by the Happiness Project by Gretchen Rubin. I love her idea of studying what makes us happy and then trying to apply it to our own lives. Everyone's Happiness Project would be unique, but I am sure would have many things in common. She has challenged others to have their own Happiness Project, and I am taking her up on this challenge. I have enlisted a friend to do this with me. I'll call her Jen, and I'm trying to see if my husband will join in as well. We will track our journeys together. Part of my interest in the Happiness Project is learning how some of the principles of happiness might also be applied to children. I will be exploring this as well. And most important, I know that one of the things that makes me the happiest is to share what I learn with others, so it will all be posted here. It should be fun. In the vein of being mindful and showing gratitude to those you appreciate, I've been meaning to share with you the positive effect your blog has had on my life for a while now. You posted a few things on resolutions that inspired me to come up with my own. Knowing that I needed to be specific about things that could be accomplished and that being more social would lead to additional happiness, I wrote out the following three general goals against which I could judge success at the end. 1. Take a class. 2. Volunteer. 3. Join a group. I promptly signed up for 2 courses to continue learning for my own edification. I also volunteered with a Boy Scout troop that I had been affiliated with while I was in my teens. These 2 resolutions took up much of my free time for the first half of the year. Recently, I began working toward the 3rd goal and joined a rowing club. I can tell you, without a doubt, that these 3 resolutions have led to all of my best experiences this year. I met some important friends in my economics class, have learned how to motivate and lead through my experiences with the Boy Scouts, and I'm just starting to expand my social circle by joining the rowing club while getting more exercise. Honestly, when people ask me what I'm up to, I tell them about the things I'm doing because of those resolutions and really sound interesting. More importantly, I'm feeling fulfilled and definitely happier. I'm now taking a 3rd course and considering joining a wine club. I also walk 5 times a week and keep myself motivated to maintain the habit using many of the suggestions you've shared. The one that sticks with me the most is the one from your dad about just having to put the shoes on and get to the mailbox. I've learned so much through your research and experience and just want you to know that your work is worth the effort. The impact on my life has been immediate, and I'm certain it will last for many years, if not the rest of my life. Sometimes people say that if the things they do can influence one person, then it was all worth it. Well, you have. When I found your blog, a light came on, and I thought that the members of our group would love this project as we are all indeed searching for happiness. I was right. When I introduced the idea, everyone is so excited to begin. We will meet next Monday and share some of our commandments, and I will then introduce your resolutions charts. As you say in your blog, each project will look different according to the person, but as I continue to read your blog, it has become clear to me that in the end, we are all looking for basically the same thing, happiness. To make your own happiness, to write your own commandments and check yourself with your own resolutions is simply genius. My group struggles with this search, but never had the thought of going and taking happiness for ourselves. We simply try to live better and hope that it comes. Time will tell, but certainly the group is very excited about the prospect and their homework, which was to begin their own commandments. Last weekend, my daughter and a friend met me at my mom's house. My daughter is 28 and my mom is 86. I'm somewhere in the middle. My daughter and her friend started talking about the Happiness Project and some of the precepts they had learned there. My daughter's friend mentioned the idea of really enjoying what you have, such as using the good dishes, not saving the dress for a day that may never come, etc. My mom, who is a very frugal woman, began to talk about some demitasse cups that had been passed on to her and how they were boxed up in the closet because she didn't have a display case. I suggested we go to the furniture store and find one she could use, and surprisingly, she agreed. We looked at 2 stores and left with good information about a curio cabinet. On the way out of the 2nd store, Mom noticed a chair that looked very comfortable and had a heating and vibrating feature that felt good. I ended up paying for half of the chair for her Christmas present, and we later ordered the curio as well. We all know that happiness is not in things. However, at age 86, I was so glad that my mom could have a couple of things that she will really enjoy. Her chair was delivered, and she reports that she may never sit anywhere else. When the curio cabinet is delivered, we will have a great time putting together the display of her family heirlooms. Thanks for the inspiration. It made me very happy to think that my blog had helped contribute to the happiness of people I'd never even met. Of course, that was the purpose of the blog, but I was thrilled to discover that it was actually working. "Your year is almost up," friends kept saying to me. "So, are you happier?" "Absolutely," I answered. "But how do you really know?" one scientist friend asked. "Did you have any kind of systematic measurement over the course of the year?" "Well, no. You didn't have Jamie score you each day or keep a mood chart on yourself or anything like that?" "Nope." "So maybe you aren't any happier. You just think you are." "Well," I conceded, "maybe it's my imagination, but no, I know I'm happier." "How?" "I feel happier." It was really true. My first splendid truth says that if I want to be happier, I need to look at my life and think about feeling good, feeling bad, and feeling right in an atmosphere of growth. I'd worked on all these elements, and it had made an enormous difference. For me, it turned out, the most significant prong was feeling bad. My biggest happiness boosts had come from eliminating the bad feelings generated by my snapping, nagging, gossiping, being surrounded by clutter, eating fake food, drinking, and all the rest. In particular, it made me happier to be in better control of my sharp tongue. Nowadays, I often manage to pause and change my tone just a second before I started to rant, or to change my tone in mid-sentence. I'd even manage to laugh while chiding Jamie about not dealing with the insurance forms or not looking for his missing library book. At the same time, I was having more feeling good, more laughing with my family, talking about children's literature with my book group, listening to music I liked. I'd learned a lot of ways to get more bang for my happiness buck. Feeling right had been very important to my happiness when I was struggling with the question of whether to switch from law to writing, but it hadn't been the source of many of my resolutions over the past months. At the start of December, however, I was hit by the idea for a goal I wanted to undertake to feel right in the coming year. I wanted to get involved in the issue of organ donation. We all hoped that Jamie would never need a liver transplant, of course, but his hepatitis C had made me much more interested in the issue. If I could figure out some small way, myself, to help boost the number of organ donations in the country, I'd feel as though I'd been able to transform an unfortunate personal situation into some larger good. I'd already started gathering a list of names and resources that I wanted to check out. I didn't particularly enjoy this work, but I could see that this project would make me feel right. But what had surprised me most about the first splendid truth was the importance of the final prong, the atmosphere of growth. I hadn't ascribed much weight to it, even when I'd identified it as the fourth element of happiness. My happiness project had proved to me, however, that the atmosphere of growth was a huge contributor to happiness. Although my instinct was to shy away from novelty and challenge, in fact, they are a key source of happiness, even for an unadventurous soul like me. In particular, I'd seen how the atmosphere of growth provided by my blog had become an enormous source of happiness. My successful mastery of that skill had given me feelings of gratification and mastery that in turn had energized me to push myself even harder. There was another question that people kept asking me. What about Jamie? Has he changed? Is he happier? One thing I knew, Jamie wouldn't be very happy if I pestered him to provide a comprehensive analysis of his emotional state. Even so, one night I couldn't resist asking him, "Do you think my happiness project has made you happier? Do you think you've changed at all?" "Nope," he answered. But he had changed. Without any nagging on my part, he was taking on tasks, such as doing holiday shopping or putting our finances on Quicken, that he'd never done before. He was much better about doing little chores like answering my emails and emptying the diaper pail now than he'd been a year ago. Not only did he remember my birthday this month, he wished me happy birthday the minute we woke up that morning. He organized a family party, got me a present, and took photos. He never takes photos. He'd absorbed more of my happiness talk than I'd realized, too. One day when we were out doing errands, I overheard him say to Eliza, "When we get to the Container Store, you're going to see something very interesting. Mommy is going to buy something for $5 that's going to make her extremely happy. Very little things can make a person happy. It doesn't matter how expensive something is." The item in question? A sponge holder that fastens to the side of the sink with suction cups. I'd coveted one ever since I spotted this device in my brother and sister-in-law's apartment. And Jamie was right. I was made extremely happy by that purchase. But he would never have made an observation like that last year. But of all the happiness-boosting things he did, my favorite was the email he sent me after I was angry that he hadn't made a phone call that he'd promised to make. From Reuben James to Gretchen Reuben. Subject, "Don't be mad, see below." And below was a picture of two little smiling faces cuddled together. I confess that when I started the Happiness Project, I feared that if I stopped nagging and complaining, Jamie would leave all the work to me. That didn't happen. Now, correlation is not causation, so maybe my happiness project had nothing to do with the ways in which he changed. But for whatever the reason, the atmosphere in our house was happier. That's not a very scientific standard of measurement. Maybe I was seeing what I wanted to see. Maybe, but who cares? If I think I'm happier, I am happier. That's the fourth splendid truth. The fourth splendid truth may have been the last splendid truth I identified, but in fact I'd understood it on some level from that first moment on the bus, when I had the idea for my happiness project. I'm not happy unless I think I'm happy, and by pushing myself to be mindful of my happiness, I can truly experience it. Although the first splendid truth was extremely valuable in showing me how to change my life to be happier, the second splendid truth was more important to my understanding of the nature of happiness. One of the best ways to make myself happy is to make other people happy. One of the best ways to make other people happy is to be happy myself. The second splendid truth made clear to me why working to be happy isn't a selfish goal, and why, as Robert Louis Stevenson said, there is no duty we so much underrate as the duty of being happy. When I was feeling unhappy, I felt dispirited, lethargic, defensive, and uninterested in other people. Even worse, when I felt angry or resentful, I searched for excuses to feel even more angry and resentful. On the other hand, when I felt happy, I was more likely to be lighthearted, generous, creative, kind, encouraging, and helpful. December was a crazy time for my sister Elizabeth. She and her writing partner were writing a pilot for a network TV show, one of the most important work opportunities she'd ever had. She and her fiancé Adam had just bought a house. She was planning their wedding, and she was dealing with her recent diagnosis of diabetes. I really wished that I could do something for Elizabeth. Then I thought of something I could do. I called her up. "Hey, guess what?" "What?" she said, sounding harried. "I've been feeling bad about all the stress you have right now, so I've decided," I paused for effect, "to do your holiday shopping for you." "Gretch, would you really?" she said. "That would be so great." Elizabeth's stress must have been as bad as I thought. She didn't even pretend to resist the offer. "I'm happy to do it," I told her. And I was. Hearing the relief and happiness in her voice made me very happy. Would I have offered to do her shopping, as well as mine, if I'd been feeling unhappy? No. Would it have even occurred to me to try to help her out? Probably not. The third splendid truth was a different kind of truth. The days are long, but the years are short, reminded me to stay in the moment, to appreciate the seasons, and to revel in this time of life. December's Yuletide atmosphere, the girls' little matching cherry nightgowns, the elaborate bath time routine. Most nights, I spent the time before bed racing around, trying to get organized for the morning, or crashed in bed with a book. But Jamie has a lovely habit. We call it gazing lovingly. Every few weeks, he'll say to me, "Come on, let's gaze lovingly," and we go look at Eliza and Eleanor as they sleep. The other night, he pulled me away from the computer. "No, I've got too much to do," I told him. "I need to finish a few things before tomorrow. You go ahead." But he wouldn't listen, so finally I went with him to stand in Eleanor's doorway. We gazed lovingly at her small figure flung across the huge pile of books that she insisted on keeping in her crib. I said to him, "Someday we'll look back, and it will be hard to remember that we ever had such little kids. We'll say, 'Remember when Eleanor still used her purple sippy cup, or when Eliza wore ruby slippers all the time?'" He squeezed my hand. We'll say, "That was such a happy time." The days are long, but the years are short. During the year, when people had asked me, "So what's the secret to happiness?" at different times I'd answer, "Exercise," or "Sleep," or "Do good, feel good," or "Strengthen your connections to other people." But by the end of December, I'd realized that the most helpful aspect of my happiness project hadn't been these resolutions, or the four splendid truths I'd identified, or the science I'd learned, or all the high-minded books I'd read. The single most effective step, for me, had been to keep my resolutions chart. When I'd started, I'd viewed my chart as just another fun thing to experiment with, like the gratitude notebook. But it had turned out to be tremendously important. Making the resolutions wasn't the hardest part of the happiness project, though it was harder than I expected, in some cases, to identify the appropriate resolution. Following through was the hardest part. The desire to change was meaningless if I couldn't find a way to make the change happen. By providing an opportunity for constant review and accountability, the resolutions chart kept me plugging away. The phrases, "lighten up," "give proofs of love," and "cut people slack" flashed through my consciousness constantly, and I often changed my actions in consequence. When I was annoyed when the woman working next to me at the library kept sighing noisily, I tried to imitate a spiritual master. Saint Therese tells the story of how she once broke into a sweat at the effort to conquer her annoyance when a fellow nun made maddening clicking noises during evening prayers. Even if I didn't do a perfect job with my resolutions, I did do better, and the more I kept my resolutions, the happier I was. I'd noticed idly that a lot of people use the term goal instead of resolution, and one day in December, it struck me that this difference was in fact significant. You hit a goal, you keep a resolution. Run a marathon makes a good goal. It's specific, it's easy to measure success, and once you've done it, you've done it. Sing in the morning and exercise better are better cast as resolutions. You won't wake up one day and find that you've achieved it. It's something that you have to resolve to do every day, forever. Striving toward a goal provides the atmosphere of growth so important to happiness, but it can be easy to get discouraged if reaching the goal is more difficult than you expected. Also, what happens once you've reached your goal? Say you've run the marathon. What now? Do you stop exercising? Do you set a new goal? With resolutions, the expectations are different. Each day, I try to live up to my resolutions. Sometimes I succeed, sometimes I fail, but every day is a clean slate and a fresh opportunity. I never expect to be done with my resolutions, so I don't get discouraged when they stay challenging, which they do. With each passing month, too, I realize the importance of my first commandment, be Gretchen. As great minds throughout the ages have pointed out, one of our most pressing concerns should be to discover the laws of our own nature. I had to build my happiness on the foundation of my character. I had to acknowledge what really made me happy, not what I wished made me happy. One of the biggest surprises of the Happiness Project was just how hard it was to know myself. I'd always been slightly exasperated by philosophers' constant emphasis on what seemed to me to be a fairly obvious question. But in the end, I realized that I would spend my whole life grappling with the question of how to be Gretchen. It's funny. Only once it was December and my Happiness Project was drawing to a close did it occur to me to wonder why I'd had the urge to do my Happiness Project in the first place. Sure, I'd had a bus ride epiphany about wanting to be happier, and it had been a relief and a thrill to step out of my ordinary life to contemplate transcendent matters. But what had motivated me to stick with it for the whole year? Jamie told me what he thought. I think this Happiness Project is all about you trying to get more control over your life, he said. Was that true? Perhaps. The feeling of control is an essential element of happiness, a better predictor of happiness than, say, income. Having a feeling of autonomy, of being able to choose what happens in your life or how you spend your time, is crucial. Identifying and following my resolutions had made me feel far more in control of my time, my body, my actions, my surroundings, and even my thoughts. Getting control of my life was definitely an aspect of my Happiness Project, and a greater feeling of control gave me a major boost in happiness. But something deeper was going on as well. I'd begun to understand that, although I hadn't quite recognized it when I started, I was girding myself for some awesome, dreadful challenge, or working to meet some judgment day deadline for virtue. My resolutions chart is really my conscience. I wonder if one day I'll look back on this year of my Happiness Project with wonder at my innocence. How easy it was to be happy then, I might think, on some dark, distant morning. How glad I'll be that I did everything within my power to appreciate the life I have now, just as it is. The year is over, and I really am happier. After all my research, I found out what I knew all along. I could change my life without changing my life. When I made the effort to reach out for them, I found that the ruby slippers had been on my feet all along. The bluebird was singing outside my kitchen window. Afterward. Jamie joined the clinical trial for the hepatitis C drug VX-950. The bad news? The treatment proved ineffective for him. The good news? His liver continues to hold steady. My sister's diabetes is under control. On the anniversary of my blog, I made a book of the year's blog posts on Lulu.com. When my children's literature reading group hit 20 members, we had to close the group to newcomers, and I started a second children's literature group with more enthusiasts. I did 2 1-minute internet movies. The Years Are Short, www.theyearsareshort.com, and Secrets of Adulthood, www.secretsofadulthood.com. In addition to Jamie and my mother-in-law, I also convinced my father-in-law and 8 friends to join my weight training gym. To show up, make 3 new friends, and be a treasure house of happy memories, I volunteered to be one of 2 house parents for Eliza's class at school. I contacted several people active in the field of organ donation, and after a long period of self-education, joined the board of the New York Organ Donor Network. Remember to join the Organ Donor Registry yourself, www.donatelife.net. Inspired to emulate J.M. Barrie's brilliant, strange book, The Boy Castaways of Black Lake Island, in the collection of Beinecke Library at Yale, which tells the story through photographs of the Llewellyn Davies boys, a friend and I did an elaborate project in which we wrote a skeleton story, gathered costumes, and took photographs of our children in Central Park. Now we're working on publishing this project in some form. After successfully giving up fake food, I eventually also gave up Tasty Delight, the delicious and very fake frozen yogurt sold by the ubiquitous chain in New York. I started getting up at 6:15 instead of 6:30 in order to make the morning go more smoothly. Working with the cartoonist Sherry Pear, I created a short comic, Gretchen Rubin and the Quest for a Passion. Drop me a note through www.happiness-project.com if you'd like a copy. To help other people to do a happiness project, I created the Happiness Project Toolbox, www.happinessprojecttoolbox.com, to pull together on one site all the tools that I found most helpful for my happiness project. I also created a starter kit for those who would like to form a group for people doing happiness projects. Sign up through my blog if you would like to receive a kit. My blog was picked up by the online magazine Slate, www.slate.com. I did indeed meet book reviewer David Greenberg at a cocktail party, and we had a very nice conversation. The blind date I set up in June culminated in a wedding. I sold the proposal for a book about my happiness project. And now I'm off to live happily ever after. Your happiness project. Each person's happiness project will be unique, but it's the rare person who can't benefit from starting one. My own happiness project started in January and lasted a year, and I hope will last for the rest of my life. But your happiness project can start anytime and last as long as you choose. You can start small, putting your keys away in the same place every night, or big, repairing your relationships with your family. It's up to you. First, to decide what resolutions to make, consider the first splendid truth and answer the following questions. What makes you feel good? What activities do you find fun, satisfying, or energizing? What makes you feel bad? What are sources of anger, irritation, boredom, frustration, or anxiety in your life? Is there any way in which you don't feel right about your life? Do you wish you could change your job, city, family situation, or other circumstances? Are you living up to your expectations for yourself? Does your life reflect your values? Do you have sources of an atmosphere of growth? In what elements of your life do you find progress, learning, challenge, improvement, and increased mastery? Answering these questions provides a good roadmap to the kind of changes you might consider. Once you've decided what areas need work, identify specific, measurable resolutions that will allow you to evaluate whether you're making progress. Resolutions work better when they're concrete, not abstract. It's harder to keep a resolution to be a more loving parent than to get up 15 minutes early so I'm dressed before the kids wake up. Once you've made your resolutions, Find a strategy to assess your progress and to hold yourself accountable. I copied Benjamin Franklin's virtues chart to devise my resolutions chart. Other approaches might be starting a goals group, keeping a one-sentence journal marking your progress, or starting a blog. Another useful exercise is to identify your personal commandments, the principles that you want to guide your behavior. For example, my most important personal commandment is to be Gretchen. To help you with your happiness project, I created the Happiness Project Toolbox website, www.happinessprojecttoolbox.com. There, I've pulled together many of the tools that help me with my happiness project. You can record and score your resolutions, individual or group, keep a one-sentence journal on any topic you like, identify your personal commandments, share your happiness hacks, share your secrets of adulthood, keep any kind of list, and create an inspiration board of your favorite books, quotations, movies, music, or images. Your entries can be kept private or made public, and you can also read other people's public entries, which is fascinating. If you'd like to start a group for people doing happiness projects, email me through my blog for a starter kit. If you'd like to join an existing group, visit the Gretchen Rubin page on Facebook to see if a group has formed in your city. This recording of The Happiness Project, or Why I Spent a Year Trying to Sing in the Morning, Clean My Closets, Fight Right, Read Aristotle, and Generally Have More Fun, by Gretchen Rubin, was directed by Paula Parker and read by Gretchen Rubin. It was recorded at John Marshall Sound by Tony Van Horn. It was edited at John Marshall Sound. Mixing and mastering were at John Marshall Sound. We hope you've enjoyed this program from Harper Audio. For more information about the broad range of titles from Harper Audio, Harper Children's Audio, and Cadman, please visit our website at www.harperaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Now, as a little bonus treat for you, here's a clip from my podcast, Happier with Gretchen Rubin. Each week, my sister Elizabeth Kraft and I talk about happiness, good habits, and human nature. We're sisters, so we don't let each other get away with much. You can find Happier in iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, or wherever you find your favorite podcasts. Hello and welcome to Happier, a podcast where we discuss cutting-edge science, lessons from pop culture, and our own experiences in how to be happier. This week we'll talk about how to make up your mind, why it's helpful to identify your tell, and we'll reveal the answer to the burning question, am I gonna get a dog? I'm Gretchen Rubin, a writer who studies happiness, good habits, and human nature. I'm in New York City, and with me is my sister, Elizabeth Kraft, who has a cat, not a dog.
That's me, Elizabeth Kraft, a TV writer and producer living in L.A. And Gretch, I am dying to hear the resolution to the great dog debate. But before we get into that, we wanted to give listeners an update. We talked about my blankie, Gretch, on the podcast.
Yes, your blankie.
Yes, I still sleep with my blankie from childhood. And we asked people to tell us what their blankie objects were. And we got a ton of response.
And photos.
And wonderful photos. A lot of people also had blankies, which was interesting. One mom talked about writing an ode to blankie, to her son's blankie, which I thought was sweet. And a couple of people still also sleep with their blankies,
yeah.
So I am not alone.
Yeah, and teddy bears, pillows.
Someone has their spinning ballerina jewelry box, and somebody has a Barbie doll. somebody else said their books were their precious object from childhood.
Well, I totally feel that way. I love my books from childhood. And in fact, this exercise reminds me of two children's books that I love that are very apt. One is Rebecca Caudill's The Best Love Doll, such a sweet book. And Dare Wright's uncanny books like Make Me Real and The Lonely Doll about very special blanky type objects.
Thanks to everyone for sending those in, and also to the person who said you don't have anything special from childhood because you were the oldest and your younger siblings destroyed everything. Sorry for that.
Yeah, very sad.
All right, Gretchen, this week's Try This at Home has to do with the discussion we had in episode 24 about whether or not you should get a dog.
Yeah.
It's been a lot of discussion, so I want the big reveal.
Yeah.
What'd you decide?
Okay, so this is going to be a very long-winded answer.
Okay.
Now, I'm an upholder in the Four Tendencies framework, and I knew that I could say no. So I didn't feel like I had to say yes just because other people in my family wanted me to say yes. I felt that I could say no. And I knew that if I did say yes, it had to be because I was doing it for myself. And several listeners made this point, which is that if you do it for other people, you're going to feel resentful because you'll end up doing a lot of work and you'll just feel put upon. And that's not even fair to the dog. It's not fair to you. So be very cautious. And so I knew if I did it, I had to be doing it for my own reasons, do it for myself. And so why would I do it for myself? And as I explained in episode 24, like I was really caught between trying to make a decision. Because on the one hand, I know myself. I don't like errands. I don't like trouble. I'm not a dog person. I knew I would end up doing tons of work. Like, it makes it harder to travel and make plans, on and on and on. But I also knew, on the other side, that all the happiness research suggests that dogs do a lot to make people happier and healthier, and it's a whole important relationship, and relationships build happiness. I knew it would make everybody in my family happy, and that's important to me. And I also really did suspect, and I do suspect, that on the other side, I'll be glad that I got a dog. Like right now, I'm like, do I want a dog? But then I thought, if I had a dog, I thought I would look back and be like, yes, I'm glad I had a dog. And many listeners said that. They were like, I wasn't sure, or I was scared of my dog, or whatever. But now I'm glad I had my dog. So I was caught. I had these pros and cons. They felt very balanced. I didn't know what to do. And this is the Try This at Home, which I'm getting to slowly. Which is, how do you make a decision, an important decision, when you feel like you're caught between the pros and the cons? You know, you've made your list on your legal pad and you can't figure out what to do. And so a friend of mine told me this thing that she thinks about, and it's so helpful. So this is the Try This at Home tip. If you're caught trying to make a decision, choose the bigger life. And the thing that I love about this, and why Choose the Bigger Life is so helpful, is that it's not the same for everyone. It reveals a lot about you to what you would decide was the bigger life. For some people, not getting a dog would be a bigger life because they want to travel. They want to have adventure. They want freedom. They want the money. They don't want to spend the money in that way. They have other important things that they need to do. And the bigger life would be, no, not to have the dog. But I realized that for me, the bigger life was to have the dog, because I can only grow. I can only have the atmosphere of growth from the inside. Like for me, it would be a better relationship. It'd be like learning this whole new area of the world. You know, I've been reading all these dog books, you know, trying to think about it. It kind of opens up the world, and it's going to be so important to my family. It'll be some whole new adventure, some whole new thing that we'll share.
So you are getting a dog.
Yes.
Okay.
We're getting a dog.
We need a sound effect.
And Bingo was his name.
Yeah. Yes. We're getting a dog. We're choose the bigger life. In my case, and in the case of my family, that was the bigger life for us. Now, how about you, Elizabeth? Is there a point where you were sort of trying to decide, you're kind of on the fence, and you decided to choose the bigger life, and you were glad you did?
Yeah, well, it's going to be a little anticlimactic after our weeks of angst over the dog. But one example I can think of is a few years ago, Sarah and I were making a pilot. And
which one?
The question was called The Selection. It did not go to series.
Yeah.
But the question came up as to where we were going to shoot it. And the studio said we could go to Budapest to shoot. if we chose to. You save a lot of money being there, and it's very beautiful, and they had all the kinds of things that we needed in terms of locations. However, they had never shot anything there. There's, you know, a language barrier. There's all sorts of, you know, obstacles in doing that. And so we were just sort of debating this, and we decided to go for it and have